ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. Do we need a new theory for how life began? I'm Eric Anderson, and today on our show we have Dr. Brian Miller, Research Coordinator at the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Miller holds a PhD in physics from Duke University and has done work on complex systems. He has spoken internationally and written extensively on the origin of life, including as a contributing author to the recently updated and expanded volume, The Mystery of Life's Origin. Brian, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So what I wanted to do today, Brian, is analyze a recent conversation that took place between Jeremy England and Paul Davies on the show Unbelievable. The conversation was facilitated by Justin Brierley, and the topic of the show was the origins of life. Do we need a new theory for how life began? So I thought we might just dive in and talk about some of the pluses and minuses of this conversation that took place between these two researchers, if that sounds good.
Yeah, that sounds terrific.
So previously, Brian, we've talked in some detail about England's work, and I think this gives us a good opportunity to consider how his view sits within the broader naturalistic framework of abiogenesis research. First, maybe just remind us, for our listeners, who are Jeremy England and Paul Davies?
Yeah, Jeremy England is a very well-known professor dealing with the issue of non-equilibrium systems. And that simply means if you have some physical system and you perturb the system, like you shove energy into it or you put some force on it, you push that system out of equilibrium. And what it can do is produce very interesting patterns. And that's the center of his research. And he has suggested that these same principles that he studies in his research could help explain the origin of life. And he was a professor at MIT, where he did a lot of his pioneering research. And now he's a research professor at Georgia Tech. And also, he is one of the directors of the artificial intelligence of GlaxoSmithKline. And Paul Davies is also a very respected theorist in the origin of life. He's a physicist. He's written terrific books on the topic. And he and his colleague, Sarah Walker, have done great articles talking about how a central challenge of the origin of life is the problem of information. So I've interacted with both of them, and they're both very, very cordial professors.
Excellent. Yeah, I know you've had some great exchanges, some debates, some conversations, we'll call it, back and forth, and really appreciate their willingness to engage. So let's first talk about the positives. What did you find that was productive and positive about the conversation that England and Davies had?
Well, both of them are very honest, and I greatly respect that. And what happened is Jeremy England talked about his ideas of non-equilibrium thermodynamics. He talked a bit about how he envisions the origin of life to have occurred, and he's a very articulate speaker and did an excellent job at that. And also, Paul Davies talked about how he understood the challenge of the origin of life, and he was very honest about the fact that an issue is information. And he is also very honest about the fact that there is no known physical principle that will do what needs to be done to produce life, to create this information de novo. And he also was very honest about his philosophical perspective. So when he was discussing his ideas, he basically acknowledged that the reason he doesn't appeal to the idea of design is because philosophically he doesn't like the idea. Mm-hmm. So he simply wants there to be a principle of in the universe that originates life, even though none has been found.
Yeah, so at least he's well. You know, the first step on the road to recovery is recognition, right? So it's good that he's recognizing his position there and understanding that, hey, the reason I'm not willing to consider design is not because of the evidence, but because of my personal philosophical approach. So at least he's upfront about that, which is great. So let's talk first about England's work. You mentioned this idea of non-equilibrium systems. What's the tie that he's trying to make there? Why does he argue that that's relevant for origin of life?
Right. Well, he recognizes that a big challenge with the origin of life is this problem of getting very specific structures that can channel energy that's available in the early Earth, something like sunlight or something like chemical energy, in a way such that you're not disrupting the system, but you're actually producing a stable order, something like a cell. And he realizes that that's something that's very unnatural. You don't really see that happening in the real world. So he assumes that there are these underlying physical principles that if you drive a system with the right type of energy, what'll happen is it'll self-organize in such a way that you'll move towards life. And he's done some very interesting experiments where he's done simulations where if you have, let's say, a series of beads that are interconnected with springs and you drive them, then what'll happen is a system will sort of self-adjust that it can actually absorb certain types of energy more effectively than others and channel certain types of self-organizational behavior. So that's his basic idea.
Yeah. And when, like you say, he's very articulate when he lays it out, it might be easy for the layperson to say, oh, gee, you know, that sounds plausible. That sounds like something that could happen. But you've written on why this doesn't work. And I think the individual who was Justin Brierley, who was facilitating discussion, even pointed to your critique as to why this doesn't really work in practice.
And I was very honored that Justin Brierley talked about that. And basically, the challenge is that his ideas in principle make sense, and in principle, they could help move systems in directions that are unusual. But in practice, it won't work in the real world from all that we can tell. And here's the big challenge, is that, and this is something Jeremy England has articulated very nicely, is the big challenge is if you want some energy source to produce some interesting behavior in a system, whether it's a simulation like a beads or colloidal spheres in an experiment, then you have to design the system very carefully. You have to make sure that you have the right energy source, it's producing energy of, let's say, the right frequency. And then you have to design the physical system in such a way that it interacts with that energy source in the right way. So again, this gets back to the problem of information, that the experimenters put information into the system in their experimental protocols to set everything up just right to get the behavior they want. The problem is, when you look at the origin of life and what was taking place on the early Earth, you don't have that type of matching. You look at the possible energy sources, whether it's sunlight, whether it's, let's say, there's some sort of geological event that produces a sound wave, or you're looking at something like chemical energy. What happens is those energy sources are in no way, shape, or form matched to anything useful to life. In fact, here's another problem, is that if you look at all these experiments that create the self-organizational behavior, you're typically dealing with one type of material. Like you're using these beads, which are all the same physical materials, the same size and so forth. Or in the simulations, you're using the same basic components that are interacting. In life, what you have is a myriad of different chemical reactions and processes, and they're quite distinct from each other. In fact, a lot of these reactions require completely different physical conditions. Some require higher pH, some lower pH, some aqueous environments, some without water. And the way a cell gets around that problem is it has enzymes that create the right microenvironments. It creates the right matching between some chemical energy like ATP and the chemical reaction. So the fact that everything is so different in life means that even if by some miracle you have matching between some energy source and, let's say, one reaction, you'll never have matching with like hundreds of different processes and reactions. So that's the big challenge that these ideas face.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I think that one of the key issues here is that it seemed, you know, you mentioned, let me push back on you a little bit, Brian. You mentioned that it seems plausible in principle, but not in practice. I'm not sure it seems plausible in principle, because once you understand how these systems work and what they're driving toward, they're really driving away from life at the end of the day. If they're followed to their logical conclusion, you end up with either a very specific set of repeating patterns, which is exactly what we don't need to build life and to store information and to have those types of processes available, or it just breaks things down. So I would argue that there's some real problems with England's approach, even as a matter of basic principle.
That's a fair point, because when I say in principle, I don't actually mean, I'm being very generous because he is a very nice man, but I'm saying in principle in the most abstract sense.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Imagine some system where you get some sort of self-organizational behavior.
Imaginary, yeah.
We physicists are very good at very deep abstractions.
lots of imagination. Good. So one of the things that I wanted to note, it was that England responded to this in a way that suggests that we need to rethink life. What's his point there? What's he trying to argue there?
Right. Well, there's a very key moment in the interview, which you alluded to, is when Justin Brierley talked about my critique that this might seem possible in an abstract sense, but it doesn't work in the real world. And in his response, essentially, was that that's because we're biased. That's because we think of life as somehow a very special system. But he imagined that if you go back far enough in our Earth's history, then possibly what would have been the precursors to life were somehow very different. They were somehow very mundane. From our perspective, they would not seem that unusual. So he made an amazing quote. He said, "One person's information is another person's noise." So he was sort of relativizing all this. And that's kind of the way how he gets around this issue, is he just sort of imagines that somehow early in life, things were very, very different, and perhaps much more mundane systems were the precursors.
Yeah. So first of all, let's just be very clear. Is there any empirical evidence for that at all?
No. In fact, if you look at the empirical evidence of what does it take to have a minimally complex cell, like what does it take to have anything that even remotely looks like a cell that can self-replicate, that wouldn't simply break down. And it's extremely complicated because whenever you take the smallest steps away from any chemical system on the early Earth towards life, you have to go to higher free energy. You have to go to a state of lower entropy, of extremely extreme organization, of greater order, and of high energy at the same time. And the problem is, as soon as you move a system in that direction, every natural process is going to try to break it apart and bring it back to a system of equilibrium. And in fact, England even talks about that in his book, which I thought was very well articulated, was that the challenge with life is that life is constantly breaking down. Proteins are unfolding. You have DNA replication, which has errors. So there's enormously complex machinery in life that's constantly repairing it and keeping it out of equilibrium. And that's a big challenge. That has to be true at the earliest stages of life, because again, as soon as you go out of equilibrium, you're trying to move back towards it. So you have to hold it in that very unnatural state. That's the big challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned that England had said one person's information is another person's noise. And I know that England and Davies weren't aggressively debating here. This was a very cordial conversation they had. But emphasize for us just a little bit more, Brian, this point that Davies was saying, because he was really focused on the issue of information as being a key characteristic of life. And it seemed like England was, you know, acknowledging that in some way, but at the same time saying, hey, maybe that's not quite as important as you, Davies, think it is.
Yeah. And they were really talking, I won't say they were talking past each other, but they were really presenting their own perspectives on the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So England is very much focused on these non-equilibrium systems and self-organization. And he's not a biologist per se, although he has studied some biological systems.
Yeah, he's got a biochemistry background.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So he's not doing the biological research, but he knows some of the biochemistry. And the big difference is when you do biochemistry, you're looking at, let's say, chemical reactions, but you're not necessarily taking a step back and looking at the cell from the perspective of an engineer. And that's a big challenge, because when you look at what does it take to have self-replication, and engineers have studied this. They looked at it with like NASA space probes. They've looked at it with robots. What you have to have is very specific functions. You've got to have information processing. You've got to have energy production. You've got to have repair. You've got to have waste disposal, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the problem, because you're talking about a very, very specific set of mechanisms, which are very, very different from what anything happens on Earth. And Paul Davies recognized that. And he basically puts all those challenges under the idea of information, that information is essentially that which constrains outcomes. It gives you specific results. You have specific patterns. So he envisions that somehow information has causal power over the world, or causal purchase is what he said in one of his articles. And he imagined there's some physical process that will cause this information to come into being and to act in the physical world in a certain way. But again, he recognizes that there's nothing even remotely like this in what's ever been discovered.
Yeah. So let me just give you my impression of what England is trying to do. So he's studying these interesting systems. He's done some interesting research about how these systems are driven far from equilibrium with an input of energy. And there was a lot of discussion at the beginning of their conversation about, you know, the difference between closed systems and open systems, which we could debate and talk about. But so he's studying these systems that, in my understanding, really have very little, if anything, to do with origin of life. But what England does is he says, well, if we redefine life to be like these systems that I'm discussing, then my work relates to origin of life. And so I can write a book and give talks and interviews about the origin of life and how my work relates to the origin of life. But the only reason it's even relevant is because he's stipulated this sort of private definition of life, which nobody else uses, that relates to this work that he's doing. Is that too critical on my part, or is that, I think there's a little bit of a bait and switch or circular reasoning going on in his approach.
I think he actually would agree with you that, in fact, if you look at his papers, he'll say that this is more analogous. So he's not claiming to produce any like specific theory of how, let's say, proteins could form. Because again, what this commonality is the issue of a non-equilibrium system. That if you, let's say you boil water, what happens is in boiling water, you're putting heat into it from the burner. Mm-hmm. And then heat is leaving through the top, through the steam. You have both, and you have a material leaving too. And the idea is that if you've got this flow of energy and at times a flow of materials, you get self-organizational patterns. So in your, let's say you're boiling water, you'll get maybe a roll pattern. And he's saying essentially that's what happened in life. That in life, what's taking place is it's taking energy into the system. Either it's sunlight if it's photosynthesis, or it's a bacteria feeding off, let's say, glucose. And it's giving off both waste and energy. It's giving off heat, and it's producing waste, either like maybe carbon dioxide, depending upon what it is, or oxygen. And what happens is that flow of energy and mass through a cell, let's say, allows it to maintain that very specific order. So again, it's that, and that's the connection he makes, is the idea that you've got energy flowing in, energy flowing out, and self-organization. And of course, that's a very generic similarity. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's massive differences. And he even acknowledged that the devil is really in the details, and that's where things get challenging.
Yeah, and I noticed that there was some conversation about order. And this brings us to one of the issues we've discussed in the past, Brian, is that there's a lot of people who get confused with the idea of mere order, which is easily producible by physical systems. This happens all the time, versus functional organization, which is a whole different ballgame.
Yes. And I remember seeing a really, really elegant chart about this. In fact, you may have even produced it, that you can talk about systems of having order and energy kind of on a grid. And a system of, let's say, low order and low energy would be like a very messy room. You just have things thrown all over the place. They're on the floor. There's no order, and everything is at a very low energy. It's kind of lying on the floor as opposed to in your closet. Another possibility is low energy and high order, that you can have, let's say, a salt crystal. So a salt crystal is very ordered. It's in a very nice lattice, mm-hmm. but it's very low energy. Yeah. And you can also have a situation of order, but high energy, and that would be like a tornado. So you have all this energy going in, you have an order, which is like a funnel cloud. But the problem is that order is at a very macroscopic state. It's a very large scale order. It's typically on particular length scales. But at the microscopic state in a tornado, you have lots of entropy being produced. It's very disruptive. It's ripping everything apart. The challenge is if you want to have a system of very high order and at the microscopic level and very high energy, like let's say a computer or a cell or something along those lines. And no natural process ever does that. Natural processes always tear apart systems of both high order and high energy. And the other issue is the issue of specificity. So if you have, let's say, a crystal, it has a lot of order, but it doesn't contain information. It doesn't have complex patterns per se,
right?
Which is very different from, let's say, a computer where you've got digital code, where you've got computer chips with very specific arrangements of molecules. So it's the issue of specificity, which is enormously difficult because no natural process is going to create information or something highly specific to serve a functional goal. That's not what nature does.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thanks so much for being with us today. I'd love to have you back to continue our conversation.
Yes, that would be a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of ID the Future. For more information about the origin of life, join us at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. As always, if you find these conversations a valuable contribution to the conversation about origins, please feel free to share a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org.
This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.